thanks for joining us this morning. We've got a special guest and some specialists on the line, we hope, but we're going to start with introductions and the county roll call. I'm going to start down in southeast Wisconsin in the Upper Rock, Lower Rock, Fox, southeast in the Milwaukee River watershed, Sheboygan watershed. Is anybody on from there?
Barb Larson in Kenosha, so we're Des Plaines watershed.
Oh, thank you. Yay.
And Lake Michigan.
Very cool. Yep.
And Fox.
Yep, Fox. You have a report for us?
Sure. We're getting lots of calls about wasps, yellow jackets, hornets, those kinds of things. The other one we're getting again this year is a lot of tar spot on maple. We're also getting some samples coming in where fruits are not developing really well. We had a raspberry just this morning. It looks like poor pollination on the fruit. And then also things that just aren't looking really good because we've gotten a little rain, but it's still awfully dry down here. And that's pretty much it. A lot of ID questions, too.
Thank you, Barb. Is anyone else down from southeast Wisconsin watersheds? Okay, how about Door County, Lower Fox, Wolf River, Green Bay, Upper Fox?
Okay, that'd probably be me in Outagamie.
Okay.
The weather's been actually really beautiful. Just nice, crisp kind of fall days. The questions I've been getting have been all over the board. Still a couple issues with trees that were damaged in the 6th tornado storm a couple weeks ago and what to replace them with and how to deal with it. One question that actually I was going to put out there about someone who was going to replace his locust tree that got broken in the storm with a Kentucky coffee tree, but actually it died from canker. The locust tree died of canker, and he's wondering if he should plant the Kentucky coffee tree in the same hole. Some kind of mysterious things. There was a woman brought a little, I can't even describe it. She took a knife and dug it off her siding, and it's just one spot the size of a nickel. Brown dust comes off it, and it was seriously attached to the siding. So just a lot of different things going on.
Thank you.
This is Vijay from Brown County. I'd like to echo what Bob Lawson has stated down in southeast area. We are getting a lot of questions regarding to tar spots on maple trees. Also questions regarding to wasp and bees issues. People are noticing a lot of stressed trees showing some early fall colorations here. But it's been fairly a dry week, actually. We need some rain here. Also questions related to raw renovation practices. So that's pretty much most about it. And some few plant ID questions.
So you guys need the rain.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyone else from the Green Bay, Upper Lake Michigan, Wolf River watersheds? How about the Lower Wisconsin, the Sugar, the Pecatonica, Grant? Southwest Wisconsin, Bad Axe. Anyone on from Madison, Dane County? All right. How about the Central Sands?
This is Sophie in Portage.
All right.
We've been extremely dry. We need some rain. It has cooled off somewhat. It's starting to feel like fall. Harvest season for the potatoes and corn, that's starting right now. We have asters blooming along the roadsides. Species roses, rose hips are ripe. This week we've seen a lot of yellow jacket questions, a strawberry root weevil, spruce gall adelgid, and a lot of plant and ID, plant and insect IDs. And that's about it.
Anyone else from central Wisconsin? How about over on the western side of the state, the lower Chippewa, St. Croix, Buffalo, Trempealeau, Black River?
This is Diana in Pierce County. I guess we're St. Croix and Mississippi and all that kind of thing. We have, again, a lot of wasp questions. They're really starting to be active and sticking their nose in everybody's face. The drought monitor came out yesterday, and we are in extreme drought. There's a little spot here between us and Eau Claire and heading north a little bit that's in extreme drought, and it is extreme. Everything is crispy. So we're getting a lot of questions related to that. A lot of vegetables that are kind of shutting down quick if they're not getting enough water on them. We've got trees starting to show stress and kind of go off color. And like I said, everything is just kind of crispy. Nothing really standing out. Our raspberry questions continue, but they're settling down some. And just weird things, you know, the unusual things like related to dogs and yards and odd things, and then a lot of ID stuff, especially weeds, because that's the only thing growing in the drought. So that's about it.
Yeah, I understand that drought is spreading just like a fire almost across the counties there. It's really hard. How about Lake Superior Basin, Upper Chippewa, Upper St. Croix, Upper Wisconsin, Northern Wisconsin? I guess I can speak for Douglas County. I would say one thing I noticed is that we're having less questions about yellow jackets than we usually do, and I just don't really know if they're just kind of late or what's going on up here. We're getting a lot of emerald ash borer questions, and we did dip into the 30s up here, certainly, in different areas, though I haven't heard anybody tell me that they've had any frost yet. Apples are starting to show up a lot at the markets, and I'm starting to work with people on putting their gardens to bed and thinking about their fall lawn care. So those are all topics that are on our minds up here. Anyone else out there that joined us? How about specialists on the line with us today?
Now, Phil's on. I'm not
all
sure.
Right.
Brian, probably not. But
okay.
This is Joe Vinerostom. I've joined as well.
Welcome, Joe.
Thank
you. So on the insect side of things, you know, the wasp story, in a bad year, they start this scavenging for protein and sugar on the 1st of August. And so the later it comes on, and it does come on, this is basically they're desperate for food to rear their young. When it comes on later, it's usually a combination of a cool year, and then the colonies are growing slower, so they don't get that desperate point. So it's going to be another couple, 3 weeks, I would think, maybe even 4 weeks if it's a mild fall, and then the populations will just crash. They're probably already a little bit on the decline. And so a couple calls that have come in have referenced that people have seen a lot of them in all areas of the yard, maybe on a particular tree. And usually the explanation of that is either there's a lot of aphids or scales that are secreting honeydew, and that's the source of sugar, or on occasion it is soft flies, caterpillars, some other protein source that they're finding. So if somebody, that's their complaint, they're all over my willow tree, you got to look closely to see what the insect problem is and then kind of decide if you want to stop the wasps from being around, you have to remove their food source. But most of the time that's kind of hard to justify in a big tree. So, and then the other conversation is if the nests are now noticed in soffits and attics and they're in a place that are not bothering people, they're probably better to left alone. The biggest mistake people can make is to plug the hole until things are treated, because then we have all kinds of problems. And I'm getting a moderate number of hornworm caterpillars still coming in and adult hawk moths. So even though the butterflies had a bad year, seems to be a pretty good year for hornworms, and so that's just kind of a fun thing for people to look at. The white line sphinx is quite active right now, and people might see that at their flower gardens. And other than that, you know, still some of these invasive weevils. I'm a little surprised with how dry it is that the box elder bugs haven't started to come on gangbusters. They certainly should. The weather is right for it. So if they don't show in the next week, that's encouraging that this will not be a bad year, even though a lot of the conditions would suggest it should be. So any insect questions? Okay, Jane, over to you.
Thank you very much. Any other specialists besides our guests today? Or maybe, Joe, you do have some general comments you'd like to make?
I don't have any general comments.
Then we're just going to,
I think we'll roll right on to you. Unless there's any other questions out there, just general questions that you'd like to ask or talk with each other about. The question that you brought up about planting the coffee tree, the Kentucky coffee tree, I think we're going to have to ask a disease person about that. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, I was going to email Brian. He's on vacation. Is that why he's not here?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Okay.
Although, you know, just, and this is from an entomologist standpoint, but the nectaria canker that's associated with it, I don't think once that tree's removed, there's anything in the soil or whatnot that one would be concerned about. So.
Yeah. I was going to say something similar. Most of those canker diseases and honey locust are prone to several of them. Aren't soil-borne, and it may even been exacerbated by stress. So he's probably fine putting Kentucky coffee tree back in there. And then you had another question. I can't remember what it was.
Well, someone asked me about tomatoes. She has tomato plants in her yard, and boys are coming over and playing ball, and the tomatoes are getting smashed into the ground. And what she wanted to know was whether she should try and get them up immediately because of pests that might be attracted to the smashed tomatoes, or if she can just wait and then just kind of, you know, work them into the soil later on. So do you think any bugs would be attracted to this and harbor in the tomato?
I wouldn't think so.
Okay.
I would maybe like picnic beetles and things like that, but that's nothing that's going to be a long-term thing.
Right.
Okay.
The only other question would be if the tomatoes are diseased, like if they have tomato blight kind of a things on them, or septoria and that, and then that plant debris is getting, you know, normally we recommend that people remove that plant debris rather than
uh-huh.
soil and stuff. So for tomato plants, if the plants and leaves are diseased, she might want to remove those plants rather than leave that in the soil because that does become a soil-borne disease for the future. But if her plants don't really have any disease on them, it's not as big of a deal.
Okay. And then actually, do you guys think if the if tomatoes or even fruit, you know, if there's some kind of disease going on, but if the fruit or the tomatoes or the vegetables look okay, or you could just, you know, if you cut them open, they look fine. Is it all right for people to eat them?
That's like one of those safety questions.
Yeah, it is, and it's. I did ask Brian Smith, I think, about it for relative to fruit, and I got a well, it depends kind of answer. So maybe that's.
You know, the general food safety, like for commercial producers and stuff, is if it hits the ground, it might have E. coli, so then it should only be cooked or processed and not eaten fresh. But there's plenty of us that pick a tomato off the ground and eat it and do just fine. So that's why it depends kind of thing. But if they can make it into sauce instead of eating it fresh, that's all the better.
So okay. If it's a fungal disease, sometimes it will affect the quality and even the taste of it. It may not be harmful to eat, but it may not necessarily be good to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And I know with some of the fungal diseases, in not talking about it falling on the ground, but some of the concern is that long-term processing, because there may be some spores or fungi in there, that's not a good idea to process those. So, again, you may want to check with some of the food safety people.
Okay, thanks. That was very helpful.
Well, now we're going to move on to Joe Van Rossum, who's agreed to be with us today to talk about a favorite subject on backyard and garden composting. Joe, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Thank you, Jane. Nice to have a lead-in talking about fungus going into compost. Certainly is helpful. What I thought I would do today would be to kind of do an overview of the programming that I do related to composting, along with Jonathan Riven, who's also a part of our group, the Solid and Hazardous Waste Education Center. For the most part, I cover large-scale composting, backyard composting, and some of the community garden composting. Jonathan's focus is more on vermicomposting and on-farm composting. And many of the resources that I'm going to talk about today can be found on the Solid and Hazardous Waste Education website at www.uwex.edu/SHWEC. So I think just about everything I'll mention will can be found there except for a couple of things. So what I'm going to do is kind of give you an overview related to backyard composting, community composting on a small scale, and then some of our large-scale composting programming. And then hopefully we can have some time at the end for a discussion, Q&A, and maybe some of you can maybe share some programming needs or some gaps that you think may be out there. So rolling into backyard composting, the interesting news is we have 8 new or updated publications at the Learning Store. Chrissy Wen and I worked on a Making and Using Compost in the Garden publication. That's a brand new one, and just within the last couple of weeks, it's been made available at the Learning Store. We also have updated versions of our compost bin plans. Those can be found either at the Learning Store or at our website. We revised some of the pictures and made them a little bit more appealing to the eye. The bin plan publications have been around for 15 or 20 years, so they were due for an overhaul. And the folks over in publications did a real good job of making them visually attractive. We've had them out at Farm Technology Days and at the Master Gardener Conference, and they've been very well received thus far. Additionally, related to backyard composting, I coordinate the Master Composter program. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a train-the-trainer program. We do a one-day workshop, typically a Saturday, where people learn a little bit more in-depth about composting. I also focus sometime on helping them to tap into their inner teacher and talk a little bit about what it takes to teach someone how to get started with composting. We provide the participants with resources so that they can meet the requirements to become a master composter, which are 3 outreach requirements, do 2 beginning how-to compost workshops, and then a display or demonstration. Typically, I've been able to do 3 to 5 workshops across the state each spring, and my plan is to send out an email in November to solicit interest in hosting one of the workshops. One of the things that's tied with the Master Composter is our Master Composter Home Study Guide. It's about a 60-page document that anyone can kind of use it as a self-guided learning tool to learn more about composting in your backyard. It's a component of the Master Composter program, but it's a good resource for someone who's looking to learn a little bit more about how to compost in their backyard. The last thing I'll mention about backyard composting is I do maintain a list of compost bin suppliers on our website. That's both for people are looking just to purchase one bin, or there are a few groups around the state that host compost bin sales. Whether it's a pre-order sale or it's a truckload sale where a vendor comes in with a truckload of compost bins and sometimes rain barrels to sell to the public. So there's a list of some of those suppliers or vendors there as well. I've done a few of those sales in the past, so I'm available for technical assistance if a group is interested in hosting one in their community. There are some groups that will use that as a way to promote backyard composting. The bins are much less expensive if you buy them in bulk quantities. And then there's also some groups that have used it as a fundraising opportunity as well. Any questions on backyard composting programming before I move on?
Roughly, when will the announcement come out for having a course in the area?
After I get the solicitation or send out the solicitation in November, I try to have the dates and locations set by early January so that we have adequate time to promote it across the state. The workshop seems to be something that people are willing to travel up to 2 or 3 hours in order to participate. So I certainly do look forward to the county extension offices that are hosting the program to promote it, but also I'm sure many of you get requests for this sort of program throughout the course of the year, and you'll be able to share it as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Moving on to community composting. How I define community composting is any composting that's done outside of someone's backyard, but on a scale that's less than 50 cubic yards in size. So it's something that's happening at maybe a community garden or at a school, something that's a little bit larger, as I said, than what happens in your backyard, but not quite to the commercial or industrial scale. There's been a lot of interest from community garden sites to have composting taking place there. It can be a bit of a challenge. Signs are very important to educate to inform people using the bins as to which bins they should be adding material to, which ones they should just leave alone and allow it to finish composting. So signage is vitally important. Otherwise, everything just seems to end up in the bin that's nearest to the garden. I'm sure many of you have visited community garden sites and seen compost piles or bins in slight disarray. But also related to that, we've seen more interest in bringing off-site materials to these locations, whether it's coming from a coffee shop, a small grocery store, or restaurants. There's been a few groups across the state that have used volunteer efforts to take material from the point of generation to these community compost sites. There's a group in Madison, one in Milwaukee. I think there's one a little bit under the radar in the Eau Claire area. And those are just the three that I am aware of. And it can pose some challenges. And in some cases, the local community has perhaps some zoning or building code issues with that sort of a practice. So I've worked with a few groups on this to help them work through some of those issues so that they can understand what the maybe local zoning requirements might be, as well as what sort of state regulations may apply to that situation. School composting is always an interesting endeavor as well. Usually I will try to get to the core of why they want to compost first. Is the goal to use the compost piles as a teaching tool, or is it one where they're trying to compost the food waste or scraps that are coming out of the cafeteria? And I think each of those goals has a very different approach that we can take towards them. With the curriculum goal, I usually try to steer them towards a single or a 2 or 3 bin system where they can manage it and see how the materials decompose or compost over time. If it's a waste management goal, then it gets to be a little bit more involved, and I really encourage them to move beyond a teacher-managed or a student-managed project and involve administration, the facility, or the janitors, as well as the kitchen staff. Because if the job isn't assigned to someone, the composting program is more than likely destined to fail because students, believe it or not, they graduate, they move on, and then they're left with a bin left behind to have someone else manage. And many times, no one is willing to pick up that bit of the process. With that in mind, a couple years ago, I created a fact sheet called Composting in School, Getting Started. It's just a two-page document with some references to other materials to help people get started. And it's just really a something to cause the people interested in composting in school to take a little bit of time, think about what their goals are and who they need to involve with that sort of a project. Any questions on community composting?
Maybe you're going to talk about this a little bit. When you work with a community group like that, like a school or maybe the courthouse or something, do you have an idea about budgeting for that? I mean, are items that would be involved in a budget?
Well, I think the challenge becomes how are you going to manage those materials? Are you going to be managing them on the specific site where they're generated, so on the school grounds or at the courthouse grounds, or are you going to be transporting them off-site to a large-scale compost facility? So my opinion is that developing a budget can be pretty important. Relying on volunteer labor is a good way to get started, but I don't think it leads to a sustainable long-term program. I think the thing that sticks in my mind is for those sorts of systems to be successful, we need dedicated operators. So dedicated in they care about what they're doing, and dedicated it falls somewhere within someone's job description, so to speak. And really, having a budget and knowing what the cost is, the first thing I tell people to do is we have to dig in the garbage and see how much is there. And then once we know how much and what is there, we can begin putting plans in place to put together a system or a plan that's going to work best for that individual location. I think we're still a few years away from having widespread infrastructure that will be able to pick up food scraps, but there are a few places around the state that is taking place. It tends to be more costly at this point in time than just putting into the trash.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions on community scale composting? Okay, hearing none, we'll move into large scale composting. So this is typically going to be at a municipal compost site. We have a number of privately operated compost facilities in the state, and there is also a significant amount of on-farm composting going on. Probably the number one program area I work for in this area is providing technical assistance to existing facilities and startups, helping them to understand the state DNR regulations, what their requirements are, what are the best management practices that they can put in place at their facilities with regard to how they're managing the materials that are coming on site, how they are processing the materials through the composting process, and how they're maintaining compost product quality through the delivery to a customer. From a startup facility standpoint, what I've found is the state regulations have been much easier to navigate than some of the local zoning issues. For the most part, most zoning codes do not include compost facilities as a recognized land use activity, so they're typically permitted underneath a conditional use permit, and it can be a challenge for some facilities to gain that local zoning permit and get up and running. So I've been involved with a handful of startups, and I continue to provide that service. I also maintain a directory of licensed compost facilities, so if you do get calls from someone looking to bring materials to a compost site, you should visit our website and search by county for compost facilities in your area. One of the shortcomings of the directory, however, is it only includes licensed compost facilities. There are some compost sites in the state that are not required to have a license. If they're less than 50 cubic yards in size, they do not need a license. And on-farm composters do not need licenses. On-farm composters do not need license if they use all the compost they produce on site. If they're selling it, then they most likely will need a license from the DNR. And with that in mind, our center has provided workshops across the state for large-scale compost facility operators, and we've also been involved with the Midwest Extension Compost School, which is a partnership between Illinois, Minnesota, and Iowa Extension to do a three-day program for composters to learn more about the process and how to produce high-quality products. Wisconsin is set to host the school in 2014, and it will be held in June at the West Madison Ag Research Station. One of the main points of the compost school is compost quality and helping producers understand what compost quality means, how to communicate to their customers what the qualities of their product are. And in order to do that, we rely upon testing procedures to do that. The one thing we've learned about compost is it behaves differently than soil and manure tests than it does underneath compost testing procedures that were developed specifically for compost. So the U.S. Composting Council has a seal of testing assurance program to help ensure that the test results are consistent no matter which lab you send it to. They maintain a list of labs on their website, and we have 6 compost facilities in Wisconsin that participate. So, for example, I worked with the city of New Holstein earlier this summer, and he had sent his compost to 2 different laboratories, and the results came back quite differently. In organic matter content from one lab, it varied by about 15% from one to the other. It also varied in the percent moisture, percent solid. So it's pretty important to make sure that people understand the test results and that the proper test procedures are in place.
So
and then
is that procedures getting evolving so that the user is real confident about what they're sending in and the lab is all on the same page? Are those protocols that are evolving, or are they already standardized?
The test procedures are standardized. They were developed about 10 to 12 years ago. And as a matter of fact, they're undergoing their first revision right now. And it talks about not only from an analytical standpoint, but there's also sampling procedures as part of it as well. So it standardizes how you collect the materials for analysis, all the way through chain of custody and through the final analysis as well, so that we can be assured that if you are comparing the analysis from one compost producer to another, you are comparing apples to apples and not apples to tulips.
So just to add to that, when our gardeners go out and buy a bag of compost, like we've got the Western Lake Superior compost, you can get it, you can purchase it on site, or you can buy it in bags at local garden stores. What they read on the bag there is, I mean, that's right, right? they shouldn't be wondering if they go to pick up a bag somewhere else that they have to translate between the two of them.
Right. Well, let's talk about what's required for bag labels. Compost can be a little bit tricky for producers to market. The only requirement for labeling on compost bags is to say the materials that were used to produce that compost. If they start making claims about, say, nitrogen content or other nutrients, then they may move into a be regulated as a fertilizer rather than as compost or a soil amendment. And in most cases, compost facilities don't want to be regulated as a fertilizer producer and prefer to be stay underneath the soil amendment regulations because there's a cost to marketing as a fertilizer. But you still should be able to ask the composter producer for a list of analysis that were performed on that particular compost. And certainly the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District produces a pretty high-quality compost. They do routinely test that material, so they should be able to provide it. However, if you were to go to, say, a big box store or a garden center, you may only be able to learn what type of materials were used to make that compost. Any other questions on compost testing? Bag labeling?
Sometimes at the farmer's market, they've got people selling bags of compost. And I always want, or even manure.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the regulation in that?
It's really, I would say it's buyer beware. What you want to be asking that compost producer is, has that material gone through a heating process? So has that compost been exposed to temperatures above 131 degrees Fahrenheit for a period of up to 15 days? If the compost has gone through that process, we can be relatively confident that the number of viable weed seeds will be significantly reduced. The number of pathogens that may be present and will be significantly reduced as well, and you'll have a much higher confidence that the compost will be of high enough quality that it should not impact your plants. And one test that I encourage people to use, it's really simple to do on your own. It's just a simple bioassay test where you take six plastic cups. In three of them, you put in some potting mix, potting soil that you know is good. In the other three, you can put your compost that you want to evaluate. And then in each of the cups, you will plant between 5 and 10 cucumber seeds. Let the cup sit for 2 weeks, and then you can compare the growth and vigor between your control, the potting mix, and your sample of compost to see what your germination rates were and to see what the plants look like, if they're developing properly or if there's some sort of deformity that has developed. If you want further information on that test, feel free to drop me an email. I'd be happy to share that in a little bit more detail.
Yeah. Thanks, that would be great.
And then finally, I'll wrap up with a little bit of research that I've been doing the past 2 summers. I've been working with Mark Renz on a project related to invasive species seed survival in compost, specifically garlic mustard and buckthorn. We did some large-scale pilot testing at the Ag Research Station, where we placed packets of seeds from each of those species into compost piles and used various management strategies on those piles. And what we learned was within 15 days, all the garlic mustard seeds had been killed, and within 30 days, all of the buckthorn seeds have been killed. But this, again, this is large-scale composting. We're reaching higher temperatures, in some cases up to 160 degrees, and in all cases up above 131 degrees, as I had mentioned earlier. And the 30-day window is well within the normal time frame that municipal or private compost facilities have materials on site. So I think that's pretty good news, at least on the preliminary side, that compost sites, if properly managed and reaching some hot compost piles, we're seeing some destruction of at least these two plant species. Hopefully within the next few months, I'll be able to have a final report and be able to begin sharing that a little bit more broadly. Well, that's what I have for you today as far as updates. I'm certainly open to additional questions on things I may or may not have covered. And if those of you out in the counties have some additional needs or some programming you'd like to see, I'm certainly open to suggestions.
Anyone have any questions right off the bat? I was going to ask if you could give general tips for our master gardeners or gardeners who are going into the winter with their home compost bins.
Well, as we're moving from the growing season into fall, remember, as we're adding materials to our compost pile, we still need to balance our carbon to nitrogen, our browns and greens. So typically we'd want about 2 to 3 volumes of brown material with 1 volume of green materials, and make sure there's adequate moisture in the compost piles as well. It should be damp as a well-wrung out sponge, which is about 50% moisture. Filling your compost bin or pile with leaves, it's going to pretty much look like leaves in the spring. But if you add in some green materials, some high nitrogen materials like grass clippings or coffee grounds, odds are your compost is going to start working this fall. It will probably freeze sometime in late December, early January. As things thaw out in the spring, the compost piles will begin working again, and you should have some finished compost by mid to late May. But really the key is balancing that carbon and nitrogen and making sure there's enough moisture in the compost pile. If people are out watering their plants, I tell them you should be watering your compost piles as well.
And as the snow falls, it's okay to keep adding waste to that pile.
Sure. If you're composting food scraps, as you're adding the kitchen scraps to the pile, go ahead and have a bale of straw or some leaves nearby that you can throw on top of those food scraps so that you're adding some carbon or brown materials to those green materials in the right ratio, so when it does thaw out in the spring, it will start working already.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Joe. That was really interesting. I've got a lot more questions, but I'll wait and put them in the email.
Happy to talk compost.
Yeah, thanks. Any other questions in general or announcements for the rest of the month of September? Okay. With that, thanks everyone for being here. And remember, next week's our last one, and we're going to kind of evaluate how things have gone. So please make a special effort to be at that one, and have a wonderful week.